A day after generals seize control in Sudan, the people are rising up.
And end of the day, we're 40 million. There's only so many bullets that the army can have. And even if they shoot at us, they can't kill us all.
Also ahead, a former Israeli soldier has an epiphany while having dinner with a Palestinian family.
I'm like asking someone to pass me the rice, and I take a look at the door and I realize that this is exactly what was happening before every single time I barged in through a Palestinian door in the middle of their dinner.
I'm Carol Hills. Also on the program, thousands of migrants are marching from southern Mexico to that nation's capital. They're seeking asylum, but finding a system in disarray.
Collapsed, underfunded, and understaffed.
Plus, France's plan to save local bookstores and beat back Amazon. That's all ahead and more on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Sudan's capital, Khartoum, today, calls for civil disobedience came blaring from a loudspeaker attached to a mosque. The voice is saying, don't go to work, to punish Sudan's military for betraying the revolution. Yesterday, generals seized power in Sudan. The military has cut most phone and internet service. Protesters have created blockades of burning tires, and soldiers are pursuing them, reportedly going door to door. Dalia Abdelmonim is a Khartoum resident. She says the capital is tense today.
All the businesses, shops, offices, the exception of maybe local bodegas, everything is closed. It's literally a major strike. Anyone who's out on the street is either going to try and get supplies or just trying to get to family or something. But the city is pretty much dead. And that's, I think, the case throughout the whole country.
There were reports of protests. In some places, soldiers were on the streets using live ammunition, reportedly have killed at least 10 demonstrators, 140 wounded. Do you think Sudanese will back down in the face of this kind of violence?
Absolutely not. If anything, when we went out in 2018 and we stood up strong against Omar al-Bashir and his army, it proved to us that, you know, nothing scares us. And we've reached a point of no return. We really can't go back and accept this attempted coup by the military. We'll just keep pushing forward. We'll keep protesting. We'll keep going out in numbers. And end of the day, we're 40 million. There's only so many bullets that the army can have. And even if they shoot at us, they can't kill us all. I mean, honestly, personally, for me, I've just reached that point where I'm like, do it. Nothing's going to stop us. We really are not going to take it lying down, so to speak.
You sound defiant. How broad is popular resistance to this coup? Does it extend beyond major cities?
I mean, I'm getting videos of protests in Port Sudan. You know, we're getting protests from all other cities in the country. It's not just Khartoum. We've all been burnt by the military in the past. I mean, we have history with the military, and it's not good history. And there's no way we'll allow history to repeat itself, so to speak. So honestly, I don't think anyone will accept this attempted coup. We're going to stand up to it. We'll do whatever we can within our means, within our limited means, to make sure that, you know, what we, the people, want comes to fruition. We want a civilian government. We fought long and hard to have a civilian government, and we're determined to get it. I can't fathom the idea that I can go back to being ruled by the military again. I just can't.
Sudan's top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said today, Sudan's prime minister Abdullah Hamdok is at my home and he was in good health and would return home when the crisis is over. He didn't use the word under arrest. What do you make of that?
Okay, why wasn't he sitting next to him? If he's fine, if he's not under arrest, why not bring him out? Let him speak to the people. Why did you arrest the other ministers? Why are you firing at the protesters? If you're really trying to save and be the savior of the revolution, why cut the internet? Why switch off our phones? This transitional government was a partnership between the military and the civilians. And yet he's putting all the blame on the civilians. You know, if you are a part of the revolution and you do want to save the revolution, you do not go about by arresting ministers, beating them up, taking them to unknown locations, and then coming up today and saying, oh, yes, the prime minister is with me. Where is he? We want proof. Why isn't the prime minister speaking to us?
It's always been a kind of fragile thing, this civilian military government. Were you worried something like this would happen?
Always. I mean, all revolutions are messy. You know, you don't slice it, it comes out in perfect shape. There will always be mistakes made. There will always be problems, you know, arising. And we are talking about the destruction of a country for over 30 years. So you're not going to rebuild in a day or even a year or two. It's going to take time. But we also have to look at the successes that the government has achieved in that, you know, short period of time. We were removed from the terror supporting list. We got the sanctions lifted from Sudan. Our debt was relieved. You know, we're getting loans, we're getting help, financial, economic help and development help. You know, we've been welcomed back into the international arena when for 30 years we were treated as a pariah state. We were taking the steps in the right direction. And then for the military to come in and then announce that they've overthrown the government. No, you haven't overthrown the government, because we, the people, choose the government that we want to govern us.
Then what is behind this power grab? I mean, did military leaders fear prosecution or just a loss of access to lucrative contracts? I mean, why now?
I think it's a number of reasons. I think the whole ICC issue coming up was a problem. They weren't enjoying the power that they used to do before. I think there's also there's fractions within the military itself. I mean, I'm not denying it. There were problems between the civilian and the military side, and there are problems in the country that weren't being addressed properly by the government. But at the end of the day, I don't think the military was willing to step aside and let the civilians take control. With the exception of Sadiq al-Mahdi's rule, the military has always been in power, always, ever since we gained independence. So I don't think it was easy for them to be shunted to the side, so to speak.
The Biden administration yesterday suspended $700 million in financial aid to Sudan. Does that matter to the coup plotters? Yeah. I mean, do they have other financial lifelines?
Honestly, I don't think it'll make an iota of a difference, because I think they have allies with much deeper pockets and they'll be more than happy to foot the bill, so to speak.
Can you imagine military and civilian officials in Sudan sharing power again? Can that idea be revived, or is it kind of all or nothing at this point?
Honestly, that's the best solution that we could have, because the military is a strong presence. It is a strong entity. We can't ignore it. Can we do without them? Realpolitik says no. But what we do need is we need two parties who will put the best interests of this country and its people at the forefront. It's not about my political party or your military leanings or my allies and your allies. It's about what's best for this country and its people. And if we can find leaders who are willing to do that, then I think we'd be on the right track. But will we find leaders like that? On paper, yes. But in reality, things always change.
Dalia, do you intend to keep protesting and to continue to fight back?
We're all adamant. You know, we've come too far to go back now. I went out not expecting the numbers to be so large last Thursday, and I was shocked at how many people came out. And it just proved to me that we're all on the same boat. We all want the same thing. It doesn't matter what age, gender, race, class, you know, you're from. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we're all Sudanese, and we want what's best for our country. And that gave me hope that we're more aware. We know what's happening. They can't fool us anymore. And we will protest until the very bitter end if need be. But I honestly believe that just like they reached a compromise in June 30th, 2019, they will reach a compromise again, because our numbers are too big to be ignored.
Dalia Abdelmonim is an activist in Khartoum, Sudan's capital. I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead of the UN climate summit starting next week, Australia has announced it'll commit to reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. That's the target scientists say every country needs to achieve to avoid the worst effects of climate change. Australia is one of the world's largest exporters of coal and liquefied natural gas, and Prime Minister Scott Morrison had to thread a tricky political needle to get his government to commit to the target.
Australians want action on climate change. They're taking action on climate change, but they also want to protect their jobs and their livelihoods. They also want to keep the cost of living down, and they also want to protect the Australian way of life.
Morrison said his net zero plan would not shut down Australia's coal or gas production. Analyst Richie Marazian says the announcement is puzzling to Australians who see the impacts of climate change in their daily lives.
There was massive bushfires 2 years ago. There's been regular floods and droughts and extreme heat, and the Great Barrier Reef will go with more than 1.5 degrees of global warming.
Marazian directs the Climate and Energy Program at the Australia Institute and spoke today to German broadcaster Deutsche Welle. He says a slim majority of the Australian public would support a stop to new coal, oil and gas projects.
In Australia, whilst fossil fuels are a major export, they don't provide a lot of jobs, they don't provide a lot of income, but they have a lot of political influence. particularly in some regional seats. And that's what's held Australia back for so many decades.
Morrison today also said he would not be updating his country's plan for cutting emissions by 2030. That leaves Australia's near-term target relatively weak compared to other developed economies. Several thousand migrants are making their way from the Guatemala-Mexico border north. Some will head to Mexico City to seek asylum in Mexico. Others are hoping to reach the U.S. Increasingly, migrants are coming from beyond Central America, from places like Haiti, Cuba, and Ecuador. The World's Daisy Contreras reports on these shifts and whether Mexico is prepared to receive even more migrants.
En 20 días nos vamos.
The announcement came earlier this month. We're leaving in 20 days, says activist Irenio Mujica on social media. He's standing with Haitian migrants in the streets of Tapachula. It's a southern Mexican city right at the Guatemala border. Some migrants have been stranded there for months, blocked by Mexican officials.
No nos puede detener y ellos lo saben.
They can't stop us, he says. Mujica is with Pueblos Sin Fronteras, or Towns Without Borders, a migrant advocacy group. He's a U.S. citizen who often travels with migrants to the U.S. border. Last Saturday, he set out with about 3,000 people, including families, from Tapachula. We want to reach Mexico City, one man tells the TV network Telemundo. He wants to seek asylum in Mexico. It's an option some people are hoping for. But it's complicated. Mexico's National Guard is turning migrants away, and there are cartels who can kidnap and extort migrants, says Charlene De Cruz. She's an immigration lawyer in Brownsville, Texas, who's traveled with migrants in the past.
And even though Mexico isn't safe, we know that, but at least they're trying not to be deported to their home countries. So Mexico is the next best thing for them.
But Mexico's immigration system isn't equipped to take on a spike in asylum seekers, says Julio Rank. He's with the International Rescue Committee, a humanitarian group that's working on migrant safety in Mexico.
It's the result of a collapsed, underfunded, and understaffed Mexican asylum system that needs attention.
Rank estimates a tenfold increase in people seeking asylum in Mexico over the last 5 years. And there's another shift. Even though the Biden administration has focused its efforts to end mass migration from Central America, especially Guatemala and Honduras, in the last few months, more people are coming from countries outside of Central America, like Haiti, Ecuador, and Venezuela. Here's Rank again.
The truth of the matter is that there's a new migration corridor, if you will, that extends all the way from Venezuela, sometimes Haiti, Cuba, and other countries through Central America and then through Mexico.
The Biden administration and other governments need to expand their focus, says William Murillo. He's with the legal support group 1-800-MIGRANTE, based in New York. His organization focuses on helping Ecuadorian migrants.
Nosotros llevamos más de 12 años publicando en nuestro país los casos de migrantes desaparecidos.
Murillo is noticing the rise in people leaving Ecuador, often from the countryside, where rates of poverty and crime are increasing. Murillo's group is also seeing Ecuadorian migrants facing some of the same crimes along the migrant routes that others face, like getting kidnapped and disappearing. He says these dangers need to be part of the conversations about policy solutions to mass migration. But Murillo says something critical is missing from these talks. They're often exclusive to government officials, without migrants themselves at the table.
Quieren hablar de migrantes y en las mesas de negociación no hay migrantes. Entonces, ¿cómo quieren tener un diagnóstico de la realidad?
They want to talk about migrants at the table, but there are none there. How else, he asks, will we learn about the realities migrants are facing and the solution they think will work? For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Independent bookstores have long struggled to compete with Amazon, tough to compete with cheaper prices and fast, often free shipping. In France, a new law aimed at regulating delivery fees is about to change that. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has the story.
Even before the age of Amazon and other e-commerce giants, France had a track record for protecting its independent booksellers.
In 1981, the Lang Law, named for then-Culture Minister Jacques Lang, mandated that books be sold at the same price regardless of the store. In 2014, another law forbade online booksellers from giving discounts or free delivery. In response, Amazon set its minimum delivery fees at a single cent.
En préambule, je rappellerai que la dernière loi consacrée aux livres date de 2014.
But now the French government has shot down that loophole too.
Beaucoup de librairies indépendantes peinent à atteindre l'équilibre et sont menacées de disparition.
Speaking on the Senate floor in June, Senator Laure Darcos exclaimed that, quote, independent bookstores across France are struggling to keep up with Amazon. And the company's ability to charge just 1 cent in delivery fees means it is crushing all other competition. Her solution? Set delivery fees at a fixed price, too. Earlier this month, the Senate passed Darcos's bill, which will become law early next year. Anne-Laure Vial worked for Amazon before opening Ici Librairie in 2018, one of the largest independent bookshops in Paris. She says this new law is a, quote, game changer for her sprawling 5,000 square foot space.
So we're competing with the same price.
While the price of the new delivery fee hasn't been set yet, Vial says she typically has to charge anywhere from 7 to 9 euros per order. She also expects the forthcoming law to drive more traffic into her bookshop.
People will make the decision differently between choosing Amazon or choosing a physical bookstore, because this will be less expensive to go to the physical bookstore.
This latest tussle may be a symptom of a larger problem for Amazon's future in France. While the company's global sales skyrocketed in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, its share of the French market actually went down by 3% in 2020. In a statement, an Amazon spokesperson told me that introducing a minimum shipping fee, quote, threatens customers' equal access to books, especially lower-income readers living in small towns and rural areas. But bookshop owner Anne-Laure Vial says Amazon is the one responsible for driving local bookshops out of these communities. She hopes this new law will help bring them back.
This will have a positive benefit on independent bookstores starting in rural areas in the future.
Vial says without these bookshops, readers won't discover books and authors that go beyond the bestseller categories.
Independent bookstores are the place where you can discover new books, new authors. So it's a place where you can discover creativity.
And she's proud of the French government for recognizing that. For The World, Rebecca Rossman.
Since the start of the Syrian uprising a decade ago, much of the country has been left in shambles. Poverty, hunger, even homelessness are common. It's left Syria heavily dependent on international aid. Now, a new report by a consortium of think tanks says the cash-strapped regime of President Bashar al-Assad has siphoned off millions of those aid dollars with the help of a creative exchange rate. Karam Shah is one of the authors of the new report. He joins us now from New Zealand. Karam, for starters, can you explain how dependent the Syrian government is on aid money at this point?
Currently, more than 90% of the population live below the poverty line. According to a survey we conducted at the Operations and Policy Center 9 months ago, more than 60% of Damascenes actually would like to leave the country if they have the option. So the situation is actually very, very difficult there, and people rely heavily on aid.
Damascenes, of course, are people who live in Damascus. Besides the UN, who exactly are the donors here? I mean, are we talking about governments or NGOs or just the UN?
Unfortunately, we don't have exact numbers. Only the UN makes it clear as to how much exactly they're receiving for Syria. But other organizations, which tend to be mostly international NGOs, also receive money on their own, usually by donations from the public, and then they spend that money in Syria.
How exactly is the Syrian government turning millions of dollars of aid money into a cash supply for itself?
So the United Nations have to take the formal channels when they're transferring money to Syria, which means that they have to play by the rules set by the central bank. Now, the central bank of Syria is basically an integral part of the Syrian regime. They benefit when they exchange the money into Syrian pounds. They have to accept an exchange rate that is actually lower than that prevailing in the black market. And so currently, the rate that they have to accept is 2,500 Syrian pounds, roughly, while the rate prevailing in the black market is actually 3,500. And so that 1,000 is lost aid for UN agencies.
So are we assuming then that the Syrian government then goes out and exchanges the rest in the black market to get this extra amount? How do they get this extra amount to pocket themselves?
The United Nations agencies, when they want to send money to Syria, they deal with private banks. So it's the private bank who has to charge UN agencies a low exchange rate that is set by the central bank. So the Syrian central bank imposes on private banks to sell exactly 50% of the US dollars that they have in their accounts, the US dollars they obtained from humanitarian agencies and the UN. Once that 50% of US dollars ends up in the central bank can use it at will.
Does the UN know this? Are they aware of this creative exchange rate that is basically allowing the Syrian government to pocket money?
They've always been familiar with the fact that a rate that is lower than that prevailing in the black market is imposed on them. And they have actually tried to negotiate a better rate previously, and they succeeded. But that still left a gap of like 30% with the black market. So still not a fair rate, but they did push for it. I think they can do better if they have the support of donor governments. If donor governments stand behind them and say, no, we're not sending you money. We're sending money to the people you made their lives miserable.
What about donors? I mean, do they stop giving money to Syria until this is ironed out, or does that just further hurt the Syrian people?
Unfortunately, I don't think this is an option, and change is likely to be very, very slow for a good reason. You can't go and stop ongoing contracts. You can't go and cut cash handouts without coming up with a proper alternative.
Is this a problem in other countries that the UN provides aid for?
You can look at actually neighboring Lebanon. They have a similar situation. So the central bank also tries to do the same thing, take advantage of the difference between black market and official exchange rates. However, the situation in both countries is completely different. So for Lebanon, you have Western countries trying to actually pull the country together and prevent it from trouble. This is not the case in Syria. In Syria, you have Western governments trying to put pressure on Damascus to give political concessions.
Karam Shah is research director at the Operations and Policy Center and a scholar with the Middle East Institute. Thanks a lot, Karam.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The World. In sub-Saharan Africa, malaria is a daily fear for parents. A new vaccine for children is ready, but now Africa needs the funding.
Well, we are optimistic. We cannot imagine a situation where international solidarity will not generate the financial resources to allow this vaccine to reach those that need it.
That's coming right up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Israel's government has approved plans to spend billions of dollars to improve conditions for its Arab citizens. Money will be earmarked for housing, education, and jobs. Arab Israeli leaders welcomed the news, but said it won't erase years of neglect. War and violence between Arabs and Jews have been ongoing for more than a century. For both sides, it's often hard to see much middle ground. Over the next 2 days, we're going to take a step back from the news and hear the stories of two men. Today, an Israeli Jew, and tomorrow, a Palestinian Muslim. Each took up arms against the other side, yet there was a point for both young men when they found themselves looking at the conflict in new ways they never imagined. Shana Sheely from the podcast Spiritual Edge has our story, and a warning, some language in this story describes graphic violence.
When Dean Isakharov was growing up, his religion was all about Zionism. He felt an almost gravitational desire to protect the Jewish state.
Nationalism was the way I defined my religion and my culture and my language.
Some of Dean's grandparents fled to Palestine to escape anti-Semitism from Europe. One of his grandparents fled from Uzbekistan and fought in a Jewish underground militia to make Israel a state.
My Jewish identity was based completely around nationalism. I wasn't religious. I had Zionism. That's the kind of Jew I was. I wasn't Orthodox. I wasn't secular. I was a Zionist.
Right after high school, Dean joined an elite anti-tank unit. He trained during that first year, practicing hand-to-hand combat and using weapons. learning army Arabic.
Waqif wala ana batukhak. Stop or I'll shoot. Iftakh al-bab, which is just open the door. Lift your hands, take your shirt off, turn around, take your pants off, give me the keys.
Dean's first assignments were in the West Bank, the Palestinian territories Israel has occupied since 1967. He and his troops raided villages, patrolled streets, made arrests.
There's one time where one of my officers, we were driving outside of the village, and then he gives us a box of flashbang grenades, and he tells us to start throwing them. And he says, so they know who owns this place.
One day, Dean and his soldiers caught some guys throwing stones in the Palestinian city of Hebron, surrounded by Israeli settlements. The guys were protesting exactly the kind of behavior Dean was talking about. When the soldiers went to arrest the guys, one of them gave Dean a hard time.
I think I pointed to my gun and I said, don't make me do something I don't want to do. Damn, I need him in his chest and his face. Until he was like half passed out and a bit bloody, and I don't remember if he screamed, I don't remember if he cried, I don't remember if he was silent, I just remember it worked.
Dean grabbed the bleeding man by the back of his neck and put his hands behind his back to cuff him.
I was like smiling. We were all happy. We got some action. We did what we had to do.
In the summer of 2014, Israel declared war on the Gaza Strip, an impoverished Palestinian-governed piece of land on the Mediterranean Sea. The Israeli army would send Dean's troops there to find and destroy underground Hamas tunnels. They used bulldozers to rip up homes and farmland.
And there were a lot of, like, just dead animals stuck under the debris, and it smelled horrible. Cows, camels, donkeys, chickens. That was, like, a smell that you don't forget.
The war killed some 2,200 Palestinians and around 70 Israelis. Dean, he got to go home.
My parents were scared. They had no idea what to do. They literally like warmed up a schnitzel and then they cut it for me as if I was 6 years old. Then they were like talking quietly. Like, Dean, is everything okay? Do you want some ketchup? Is everything all right?
Dean ate his schnitzel and took a shower. Dean slept a lot. He read a lot.
Well, the more time that went past, the more I felt the dissonance between me supposed to be feeling like I'm a hero because I was one of the soldiers that was inside, and the incredible guilt.
One evening, the family's housekeeper, a Palestinian woman, invited Dean's family over for dinner.
So it was a beautiful dinner and just a family sitting there, and I was sitting right in front of the door. I'm like asking someone to pass me the rice and we're eating. And then I like take a look at the door and I realize that this is exactly what was happening right before every single time I barged in through a Palestinian door in the middle of their dinner or in the middle of the night.
Dean didn't talk about it much, except with a close friend. One day, over a beer, that friend invited Dean to a lecture by a Palestinian, Bassem Aramin.
He has this amazing story of how he came to terms with nonviolence. And one day his daughter was walking home from school. She was around 6 years old and she was shot in the head by a border police officer and killed.
Bassem was talking to Israeli students in an auditorium.
And he's telling his story and one of the kids raises his hands and he asks, why is it that an Israeli soldier would shoot a kid in the head? Like, why would that happen? And then from the back of the room, I like raised my hand and I started explaining to them about how my soldiers were in a checkpoint one time and one of my sergeants ordered a soldier to shoot a rubber bullet, which instead of hitting the kid in the leg, hit him in the chest. And while I was telling that story, my voice was shaking. And Bassem, what Bassem does is that he walks over to me while my voice is shaking with a glass of water and he gives it to me. I think that, like, I've never been worthy of so much compassion.
Weeks later, Dean met with Bassem's organization, Combatants for Peace. It's a group of Palestinians and Israelis who had taken an active role in violence and now work together to talk and promote nonviolence in the region. For the first time, he was realizing that there were worlds of stories beyond the ones he'd grown up hearing. Dean's religion had been orbiting around nationalism, but the more he learned from Palestinians, the more holes he found in his steadfast faith in the noble and moral struggle for a Jewish homeland. So, if Dean no longer believed in taking up arms for the state of Israel, what did he really have?
Suddenly you don't know where you're supposed to be, or who you are exactly, or what story you're telling yourself anymore.
Dean met other veterans asking similar questions. He gravitated towards the Israeli organization called Breaking the Silence. It's a controversial group. In fact, the law forbids the group from speaking in public high schools.
Literally, the only message of the group is, this is what we did, it's wrong. And I think that it's so controversial because it cuts straight to the core of our denial.
Dean became their spokesperson, which made him a target. His own testimony about what he'd done when he'd served in the army was posted on Facebook and used to discredit him. The video shows Dean's testimony in front of a big group. Dean is describing the day he beat unconscious the young Palestinian man who was resisting arrest on the accusation of throwing stones. And then, a man with a scruffy beard and fade haircut and the title Team Commander comes on the screen and says, in Hebrew, "It never happened." And then, one by one, 12 soldiers look straight into the camera. Dean, I was a fighter in your unit, and you're a liar.
And it's one after another, and another one, and another one, and another one, and another one.
Within 24 hours, the video reached radio and TV stations.
It was everywhere. It got to the news. It was big. People are like writing posts, and it's becoming viral, and suddenly, like, the security minister comments on it. And then the justice minister says that I should be investigated.
In April 2017, Dean declared in front of police investigators that he assaulted a Palestinian man. The investigators said Dean was lying, and they wouldn't put him on trial.
And then we realized that what we have to do right now is we have to start collecting evidence and trying to find witnesses and the victim and prove that what I was talking about was the truth.
Dean, with the help from the Israeli organization B'Tselem, poured through hundreds of hours of videos taken by its volunteers. They soon found what they were looking for: video footage of the assault.
Suddenly there's me and another guy holding the guy that I need, and I recognize him, and he's bruised in the face. My immediate response was that I broke out crying.
With proof in hand, he got right to work. He called local journalists, and soon the state attorney's office reopened the investigation. It was New Year's Eve when Dean learned that Israeli TV journalist had found the Palestinian man. His name is Faisal Al-Natsha.
I sit there watching the news, and they're interviewing this guy's mother. She's talking about the trauma that her son went through. And they're interviewing him, and he's saying, "You think one guy beat me up?" And I had to look this guy in the eyes and hear his account of it and hear his mother talking about what I did to her son.
Did you ever interact with him or talk to him?
No.
Do you want to?
No. No, because what would I do? Ask for an apology? I don't think he'd want to forgive me, and I don't think it'd be a fair thing to ask for.
As for Dean's Judaism,
it took me a very long time to realize that I can be Jewish without being a Zionist.
Now, Dean expresses his Jewish values in his activism.
I feel like it's very Jewish to fight apartheid. There's something about Judaism which doesn't naturally lend itself to supremacy. There's something about Judaism which in its core is I don't know if existential is the word as much as not materialistic. And when you're not materialistic because your God doesn't have a name or a body or a face, then you can't worship land and you can't worship flags and you can't worship symbols. You can try and do good to other people.
By sharing stories from his time in the military, even though many of his stories are painful, Dean is trying to do good for his people, his country, and his God. For The World, I'm Shayna Sheely.
Tomorrow, we'll hear the story of a Palestinian man who underwent his own transformation. You can also hear more about people whose religion or spirituality shapes their world by checking out the latest Spiritual Edge podcast. Washington continues to try and bring WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange back to the U.S. for extradition. Tomorrow, the Justice Department is challenging a British court's ruling that Assange cannot be sent to the U.S. to face trial. Washington is desperate to get Assange here. At one point, the CIA discussed plans to kidnap or kill him, possibly by ramming his car, then snatching him. Reporter Zach Dorfman broke the kidnapping story for Yahoo News and has been following Assange's extradition saga. Zach, how did you discover that the CIA and former director Mike Pompeo were discussing kidnapping Assange?
I had had a conversation with a former U.S. intelligence official who expressed a little bit of relief after the last presidential election. And I asked this person why they felt some relief. And they said to me, well, there were a lot of kind of crazy things that were being considered at the time. And of course, that piqued my interest, right? And I said, well, like what? And this person kind of demurred for a while and then said, well, you know, they were talking about potentially killing Assange. And of course, my eyebrows went up. And what we discovered from our reporting and researching was a pretty wild story about some very, very extreme things that were under consideration.
So the first person you referred to, the unnamed person, is that a national security, former national security official?
Yes, exactly.
And you can't name who it is?
I cannot name who that person is, no.
What is the evidence that there were these discussions to kill Assange or to kidnap him?
I mean, the evidence is from the overlapping granular accounts of different well-placed sources during that 2017-2018 period with whom we spoke. These were folks who were quite close to some of these discussions, remembered them in detail, and then we corroborated those recollections across different sources.
Okay, let's take the kidnapping discussions. Mm. What did your sources say was discussed? What kind of conversations were going on and who was having them?
These conversations were occurring both within CIA under then Director Mike Pompeo and then at the Trump White House, particularly at the National Security Council. And there were a variety of different shades of these discussions, you know, some which were considered kind of less extreme, although still, I think, quite extreme, was this idea that, you know, there might be an instance where U.S. operatives would burst into the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange had taken refuge and drag Assange out and then hand him over to the British. And then there would be something like a formal extradition process from there. Now, of course, it's the Ecuadorian embassy. You're violating the sovereign territory of Ecuador. You're doing it on the soil. You're staging that in London, in the capital city of our closest ally. So even that was pretty worrying for some folks. But there were also other things that were being proposed that were even more extreme.
Like what?
Like something that is more akin to a rendition. Drag Assange out, throw him into a car, get him on a plane, bring him to a third country, and then eventually bring him to the U.S.
Were these conversations, according to your sources, happening in actual meetings to discuss this? Or was it sort of people sitting at their desks spinning yarns that, gee, we might be able to do this or that?
No, that's a very, very good and important distinction. These were being discussed in formal National Security Council meetings.
Do you know whether these kind of discussions happen in other White House administrations around sensitive kind of CIA cloak and dagger stuff? I mean, how errant and odd are these discussions?
They are errant. I'm specifically recalling a conversation that I had with a former senior intelligence official who said to me, I was involved at high-level discussions in prior administrations. This would never have passed through the lips of people in the White House. You know, there are certain lines that you were supposed to know you weren't going to cross, even rhetorically, right?
After your story, two dozen civil liberties and press freedom groups wrote to Attorney General Merrick Garland asking the Justice Department to drop the case against Assange. What was their argument?
The Assange indictment includes charges under the World War I Espionage Act, which basically just charged Assange with publishing classified material, basically stripping somebody of protection as a journalist and charging him for the mere publication or retention of classified information. Classified information is published every day without running into that. And so there's a lot of worry that this is a slippery slope, and what happens to WikiLeaks or Assange today could happen to somebody from the New York Times tomorrow.
Zach Dorfman is a reporter for Yahoo News. He broke the story about the discussions in the CIA during the Trump administration to possibly kidnap or kill Julian Assange. Zach, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
In Africa, malaria is always top of mind. More than 260,000 children under the age of 5 die from the mosquito-borne disease every year. In Ghana, health officials say that's at least one child a day. There are now high hopes for the rollout of a new malaria vaccine in sub-Saharan Africa. That's after the World Health Organization recommended its widespread use among children there. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman spoke to some mothers there who just can't wait.
Alaju is a densely populated community in Accra, home to some 5,000 people. This community has over the years gained notoriety for perennial flooding due to its poor sanitation. Choked gutters strewn with human excrement and plastics are a common sight here, which can breed mosquitoes. Anita Adu has lived in the community almost all her life. She recounts her two-year-old's near-death experience with malaria.
As a mother, having a child with the body temperature being hot, unable to eat, a child can't tell you, mommy, this is where I feel the pain.
The mother of two sits on a stool on a veranda with her two-month-old baby on her lap. The two-year-old she talks about munches at a loaf of bread with a cup of porridge in front of him. Adu says dealing with malaria takes a toll on your mental health.
Sleepless nights, she'll be crying. It got to a time I had to just inform my husband that going to work and also having a sick child, it wasn't easy.
Malaria is a life-threatening disease caused by parasites that are transmitted to people through the bites of infected mosquitoes. In 2019, Ghana was among three African countries that started testing the world's first malaria vaccine. More than 120,000 children from 6 to 9 months of age here have so far received 3 doses of the vaccine. In Cape Coast, in southern Ghana, I visit Sabina Ata Asimeku, whose infant received the shots.
I am very excited I participated in the pilot program. So far, my child has not shown any side effects to the vaccine. And unlike my terrible experiences with my 3 other children, this one has not suffered serious malaria since she took the jab.
The vaccine, known as RTSS, has no known safety issues and has been shown to prevent 40% of all malaria cases and 30% of severe cases. The malaria vaccine needs 4 doses to be effective. The first 3 are given a month apart at the age of 5, 6, and 7 months, and a final booster is needed at around 18 months. Dr. Kwame Amponsa Achianu spearheaded the pilot in Ghana. He recalls how his own constant battle with malaria as a child inspired him to become a doctor.
Probably I've been building immunity from childhood. I was only fortunate to have survived, because not very many children like me did survive.
He says the country is poised to vaccinate children nationwide if the shots are made available. He, however, entreats mothers not to see the vaccine as a substitute for already existing interventions, such as keeping the environment clean.
Normally, when you have a vaccine, it doesn't mean the other interventions should be put on hold. Like the bed nets, we'll continue to sleep in the bed net. Like the indoor residual spraying.
But now, many African mothers are just wondering when their children can get the shots. GlaxoSmithKline, the pharmaceutical giant that developed the vaccine, has pledged to supply the doses at the manufacturing cost plus 5%, but has not specified the price. The UN says it is determined to ensure that no one is left behind. Dr. Pedro Alonso is WHO's director of the Global Malaria Program in Geneva, Switzerland.
Funding to secure the supply of these vaccines to African countries still needs to be worked out, but we are optimistic. We cannot imagine a situation where international solidarity will not generate the financial resources to allow this vaccine to reach those that need it.
GlaxoSmithKline says the pilot in Ghana, Kenya and Malawi will continue and has donated 10 million doses for the study. The WHO says a second malaria vaccine could help satisfy anticipated high demand. Meanwhile, in Alajo, Anita Edu gives breast milk to her two-month-old baby and waits for the malaria vaccine to reach her children.
I'm very excited. We have to thank God for this vaccine. I just wish that everyone will agree with me in Ghana here to take the vaccine.
If the money is found, then the vaccines could start being available for wider use from the end of 2022 or early 2023. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Good news out of Ghana. Now, some good music from the Democratic Republic of Congo, courtesy of the band Jupiter and Aquas.
Bakunda ulu, bafitantaka, iyo balango, o mato. Bakunda ulu, bafitantaka, iyo balango, o mato.
Jupiter and Aquas hail from Kinshasa. Jupiter is Jupiter Bonkonji, the son of a Congolese diplomat. He's the front man. Aquas is the name of the band. For the band's latest album, Nakozonga, some of the musical influence comes from Brazil. It was recorded at the studio of Mario Caldato, a Brazilian-American producer in Los Angeles. On this track, Bakunda Ulu, a message about empowerment for his people back home in Kinshasa. As Jupiter says, for people who still have hope despite the hard reality of life. New music from the Congolese band Jupiter and Aquas closes our show today. We know the world's listeners love global hits from Congo to Peru and other places around and in between. We've posted a link to a playlist with over 4 hours of great music you might have heard here on the show. That's on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us. We're back with you tomorrow. Balanga kyoto kima bao tika la kinde tekeleke ya mbondaya.